Happy Friday and welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Before we get started on the show here today, just a reminder, Pecan Day has been moved to April 6th in Yuba City, California. The California Walnut Conference will be April 7th and April 8th in Yuba City, California. And the North Valley Nut Conference will be on June 8th in Orland, California. The show will kick off with a report from Taylor Chalstrom on evaluating irrigation water for micro-irrigation clogging and salinity hazards. We'll hear from Taylor right after these messages from our sponsors.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
The Musco Family Olive Company is leading the transformation of the table olive industry. We are committed to the California olive grower and invite you to grow with our family. Modern table olive orchards apply newly perfected state-of-the-art planting and harvesting to one of the world's oldest tree crops for proven superior results. There is opportunity in any crop transition, and Musco is proud to offer long-term contracts and free trees to our grower partners. Visit us at the Agro Melora booth at the upcoming Calusa Farm Show and the World Ag Expo. See you there.
Evaluating irrigation water for micro-irrigation clogging and salinity hazards is an important practice, especially when planting new orchards. UCCE Farm Advisor for Fresno County, Meg Hulumber, discussed some of the things that growers should look out for when evaluating irrigation water quality during the 2021 Pistachio Day. This would include particulates, which is the fraction of sand, silt, and clay in irrigation water, organic contaminants such as algae and bacteria, chemical precipitates such as lime, bicarbonates, iron, manganese, sulfides, and even sometimes injected fertilizers, and salinity and toxic ion levels, such as total dissolved salts, electrical conductivity, sodium, chloride, boron, and bicarbonates. Columber said there are two sources of water that growers can be monitoring.
There may be different problems that can arise from either surface or groundwater. So this could influence what factors you request for the evaluation of your samples. Surface water sources can be a micro-irrigation emitter causing hazard due to particulate matter and or organic matter in the water. But particulate matter can appear in both groundwater and surface water. So generally speaking, the organic material is most often associated with surface water, but we do find it in groundwater. Surface water is generally low in salts, which is, you know, good for using this, you know, for production of the pistachio, and then also for leaching. And groundwater, we tend to have higher levels of salts associated with that.
Coulomber explained water sampling and analyses for groundwater.
We're going to want to run your pump for at least 15 minutes before collecting a sample, and then you're going to need at least a liter collected into a clean container and have it analyzed for the chemical constituent analyses. You want to make sure that you collect the sample close to the well, but in some cases, if you're trying to troubleshoot, you may want to be collecting water after the filters and also at the end of your lines. And then also with the surface water, you may need a larger sample than that liter sample that I suggested. So you may need up to a gallon with the surface waters. And then in either case, you want to deliver that sample to the lab as soon as possible. In transport, you want to store it in a cooler or keep it in a refrigerator until you can deliver it to the lab. Hot pickup truck should be avoided for storing your samples, because a lot of volatile and biological contaminants, they can change rapidly with time and high temperatures. And so that may not accurately reflect the quality of the water that you have for your pistachios.
Typical water characteristics to look at when evaluating irrigation water quality include suspended solids, electrical conductivity, total dissolved solids, pH, calcium and magnesium, sodium and chloride, boron, iron, manganese, bicarbonates, hydrogen sulfide, and bacteria.
Having a good broad picture of what your irrigation water quality is like can really help you with understanding, you know, is this something that I just need to evaluate, you know, at the beginning and then infrequently, or is this, or is the quality of my water susceptible to change? Do I need to be doing this sampling on a more frequent basis? Depending on if you're looking at surface water or groundwater, you know, some things may or may not be needed. Like I said, if you're troubleshooting, for example, you know, we wouldn't tend to see bacterial counts considered in groundwater, but if we're having problems with iron or manganese precipitates in the water, this could tend to create conditions for bacterial growth in our irrigation system. And so that may be a point where, even though we're using groundwater, we may need to evaluate those bacterial counts.
When thinking about emitters and micro irrigation when evaluating irrigation water quality, particulates is top of mind. A variety of filters are available, and selection should be based on flow rate and concentration of inorganic and organic materials in water. Some suspended particulate matter is small enough to pass through the filters and clog micro emitters.
It's important, you know, especially in the development of your orchard, making decisions early on in terms of your filtration system, and then also the size of your emitters, to understand what the suspended solids are of your irrigation source. And so what that refers to is the fraction of sand, silt, and clay that is found in your irrigation water. And so generally speaking, if this is the size of sand in relationship to silt and clay particles, sand is going to be probably likely your biggest concern. There's a variety of filters available. And this is going to be, as Isaiah had talked about a bit yesterday, the selection is going to be based on the flow rate that you have from your water source, and then that concentration of those inorganics and organic materials in the water, and with the particulates in particular, what the largest size of a particulate that you're dealing with. So some of this suspended particulate material is small enough to pass through filters and clog emitters, and that's why it's really important to do regular inspection and maintenance of your system and make sure that things are back flushing properly.
Other contaminants include organic contaminants such as algae and bacteria. Algae occur in surface waters and have green color, while bacteria have white, gray, black, or reddish brown color. Small particles of either can pass through the filter and into the drip system.
Bacteria will grow when there's elevated levels of organic matter in your water. Elevated levels of lime or bicarbonates, iron, manganese, sometimes hydrogen sulfide levels can be found. All of these, either algae or bacteria, they provide food for slime organisms. So you can go from having algae and bacteria to slimes in your system. And again, small particles of either can pass through the filter and into your drip system. So regular maintenance is recommended. One of the common sources of bacteria in your irrigation system can form when iron is present in the water and it oxidizes. So when irrigation water is pumped, it adds oxygen to the system. And so this can trigger a reaction where some elements would normally be very soluble. They can be changed to an insoluble form. And so that can result in iron precipitates out of the water. And then this iron-rich water becomes a viable food source for bacteria. And then you will see this red or yellow or tan slime that will accumulate in the drip system. One big problem with problems with bacteria is that they can occur in a wide range of pHs. So a lot of times lowering the pH will not directly address this problem.
Looking at chemical precipitates, iron and manganese are the main offenders. They exist naturally in groundwater. Irrigation pumping oxidizes them to insoluble forms, leading to scale and bacteria growth, and elevated sulfides can form highly insoluble precipitates.
Iron exists naturally in the groundwater, and it's a result of a decay and chemical reactions with the soil and rocks. As I mentioned, the irrigation pumping will oxidizes those elements into insoluble forms that can lead to scale and bacterial growth. Another factor that could be of concern could be elevated sulfides, and they can form very highly insoluble precipitates. So the formation of iron sulfides can be very problematic and may require a little bit different treatment than when you have iron and manganese problems alone. Very commonly found in our Central Valley, where we have high levels of lime that is naturally occurring, or oftentimes in an effort to address some salinity problems, the use of calcium amendments can also cause the precipitation of calcium carbonate, which can increase clogging in our irrigation system. During the summer, when we have elevated evaporation and increasing temperatures on that, especially within that drip tubing, this can also increase the production of more insoluble levels of lime. And so the pH, your level of bicarbonates, and the level of calcium in your water, you're going to want to pay particular attention to that to know if you have a plugging hazard associated with these components. And the same is going to be true with addressing salinity issues. Finally, with the chemical precipitates, injecting fertilizers, dissolved fertilizers, they can react with water and form precipitates that can clog emitters. And mixing fertilizers can also be problematic. So the best policy is not to mix fertilizers. There's a big push now to, you know, we're trying to make sure to balance our nutrition, but we want to be careful to try to limit mixing fertilizers at the same time. If you're going to mix fertilizers, make sure you do a jar test according to the manufacturer instructions before doing so. A big problem with injecting fertilizers is that when it's coupled with salinity problems, that is when we tend to see clogging hazards. So two examples would be using anhydrous ammonia or calcium in the form of like can 17. When we have bicarbonate levels that are higher than 2 milliequivalents per liter, or elevated pH above 7.5, this really can increase the risk of precipitating calcium carbonate in our irrigation system. The use of sulfates, gypsum, so again, another amendment so commonly used to address salinity issues. If you are injecting that and your irrigation water already has levels that are greater than 2 to 3 milliequivalents, that gypsum can precipitate in the irrigation system and actually cause clogging issues. It can actually cause problems in the soil as well. Injecting phosphorus, if calcium or magnesium levels are greater than 2.5, and if you have high groundwater salinity, can also lead to the formation of various carbonates in the soil.
As far as actual clogging prevention goes, Coulomber said that routine filter cleaning and maintenance are key to preventing sand particles and biological contaminants from penetrating the system. She said to flush main lines and sub mains using flush valves, and to open later line ends to flush as often as every 2 weeks. Manually flush self-flushing lateral lines periodically. Run irrigation after fertilizer injection and regular irrigation system inspection is needed, for example, looking for leaks, changes in pressure, or wetting patterns. Additionally,
in terms of clogging preventions, when we're looking at biological problems, iron or manganese precipitation, aeration and settling ponds, they can help do that. So that I mentioned that the oxidation causes these things to precipitate. We don't want that happening in the irrigation system. We want to do that possibly before we do the pumping into the system. So settling ponds and reservoirs can help with that. So we can also use chlorine to precipitate and then filter out those contaminants. And then also inhibitors and chelation products can also be very useful, but you have to use these before the iron is oxidized in the system. Carbonate precipitates, or when we're seeing levels of bicarbonates that are greater than 2 milliequivalents, pH is over 7.5, or iron sulfides in your system, those require pH control. I've mentioned both acid here and chlorine. You want to make sure that you do not directly mix acid and chlorine. That can be very dangerous. You would also want to make sure that when you inject these at two different points, probably at least 10 feet apart in your irrigation system.
In terms of salinity and toxic ion levels, some of the water characteristics used to identify other irrigation water quality issues are the same. These water characteristics are used to assess osmotic stress and ion toxicity potential, nutrient availability, sodic-induced infiltration problems, and to choose and estimate amendment rates and leaching fraction.
Salinity is most simply defined as the concentrations of dissolved salts in the irrigation water or in the soil. And here we see that some of these salts are bonded together by opposing charges. So this would be the molecule for calcium sulfate, gypsum, or sodium chloride. But then a lot of times in irrigation water, many of these bonds are broken. And so these salts exist individually as either cations or positively charged cations or negatively charged anions. Boron, which is often a very large concern for salinity, it's an uncharged trace element, and it doesn't contribute to the measured salinity, but it often occurs in environments where we see elevated levels of salinity, and because it absorbs very strongly to the soil, especially at higher pHs, this is why it is so difficult to flush out and leach from the system.
Thank you for that report, Taylor. Regional and national news coming up next. Let your bees carry a beneficial biofungicide directly to flowers and reduce brown rot, blossom blight, and jacket rot. Sign up for a field trial of bee vectoring and the biofungicide Vectorite with CR7 on your almond orchard. Deadline is January 15th for setup and use at the start of your February bloom. Email contact at beevt.com. California table growers, collectively through the California Table Grape Commission, are working to mechanize and automate operational functions with a goal of reducing costs and increasing the efficiency of vineyard operations. One of the priorities is to minimize the movement of labor and maximize production per foot traveled. A time and motion study conducted on harvest activities helped the industry understand where and how much time is spent on picking and packing tasks. A second time and motion study on in-house packing is in the process of being completed. The goal is to understand how labor is distributed across tasks and facilities and identify potential areas of mechanization and automation. Another priority is to introduce automation to the harvesting of table grapes. This work is being done with the use of autonomous carts that aid in vineyard movement of freshly harvested grapes. Other cart capabilities being tested include utilizing sensors to detect ripe berries and robotics to pick ripe berry clusters without damaging the fruit.
Institute. Other sensor research and development includes crop mapping and estimation via cluster counting, berry size measurement, and berry color detection, as well as remote monitoring for increased water use efficiency. The Commission is also researching mechanized tools to improve vineyard pruning efficiency, including handheld battery-powered pruners and tractor-mounted mechanical pruners workable in a table grape trellis system. A related product review on global tools and technologies available for mechanical pruning of table grapes was recently completed. The Commission is considering other categories of innovation, such as sensing and spot treating for pests and diseases, automated production and packing practices, and new vineyard infrastructure to facilitate automation and mechanization. And UC Davis second-year doctoral student Allison Coomer is now a global champion. Coomer, a member of the laboratory of nematologist Shahid Sadiq of the UC Davis Department of Entomology and Nematology, just won a worldwide competition sponsored by the International Federation of Nematology Societies for her three-minute thesis on root knot nematodes. She delivered her video presentation virtually on trade-offs between virulence and breaking resistance in root knot nematodes. She will be recognized and receive her award at the 7th International Congress of Nematology, which will be held in May in France. According to the chilling hour calculators at the University of California, Davis Fruit and Nut Research Center, Manteca has seen 497 chill hours and 480 hours between November 1st and January 6th. At the same time last year, the city had registered 734 hours. The previous 4 years registered 523 to 592 hours each. Chill hours are times when temperatures are between 32 and 45 degrees Fahrenheit. It keeps a tree dormant for the winter. Warm weather can cause the trees to bloom late or bloom unevenly, which makes for lower yields. Up next, a look at national news.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
CropLife America has joined more than 350 organizations engaged with pesticide products in a letter sent to Congress, affirming their support for the current pesticide regulatory system. The letter is in response to legislation that would change the science-based standards in the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. This legislation undermines the work of the Environmental Protection Agency's career scientists in the evaluation of pesticide registration and use, according to Chris Novak, president and CEO of CropLife America. He says the evaluation of each pesticide requires EPA scientists to review hundreds of studies to determine whether a pesticide can get safely used. The groups point out in the letter that the proposed legislation would jeopardize the availability of pesticide products by imposing an unscientific process that could remove pesticide control options from the market. Congress amended FIFRA several times to strengthen the regulatory standards for safety, most recently through the Food Quality Protection Act, that added specific protections for infants and children. The Environmental Protection Agency has granted new registrations and labels for Corteva Agrisciences Enlist 1 and Enlist Dual herbicides, but will not be available to growers in a limited number of counties with federally listed endangered species. The new Enlist registrations are among the first herbicides on the market with full EPA analysis of their effect on endangered species and critical habitats. The agency is adding several new measures to the label to protect these federally listed species and habitats, as well as measures to protect pollinators. The GrowMark Foundation is offering a $1,500 scholarship program for students pursuing 2 or 4 year degrees or trade school certification in an agriculture related field. Applicants must complete an online application, which includes academic information, community service and leadership activities, and essay questions regarding agriculture and cooperatives. Applications will be judged by a panel of agribusiness professionals. High school seniors or students at any level of higher education may complete the application, which can be found at growmark.com. Applications are due by 9 p.m. on April 14th, and recipients will be notified by July 1st.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced up to $225 million in available funding for conservation partners through the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. This program leverages collective resources to find solutions to address natural resource challenges on agricultural land. This year's funding announcements include opportunities for projects that include climate change, benefit historically underserved producers, and support urban agriculture. There are two types of funding opportunities under RCPP. There's RCPP Classic and RCPP Alternative Funding Arrangements. Classic projects are implemented using Natural Resources Conservation Service contracts and easements with producers, landowners, and communities in collaboration with project partners. The second alternative, which again is RCPP Alternative Funding, partners have more flexibility in working directly with agricultural producers to support the development of new conservation structures and approaches that would not otherwise be available under the RCPP Classic. USDA is accepting project proposals for both components through April 13th. You can find out more by logging on to grants.gov. Both electric vehicles and the increased production and use of renewable fuels like ethanol will be necessary to achieve a national goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. That, according to Renewable Fuels Association President and Chief Executive Officer Jeff Cooper. Here's his testimony before the Federal House Agriculture Committee earlier this week.
The emergence of electric vehicles and the push to decarbonize transportation could have important implications for farm country, and we commend the committee for thinking carefully about those issues. As you know, the massive increase in public and private investment in electric vehicles is being driven by the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and achieve economy-wide carbon neutrality by 2050. Transportation is the leading source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., accounting for nearly one-third of our nation's total emissions. Thus, any strategy to achieve net zero emissions by mid-century must include measures that rapidly decarbonize the transportation sector. We agree that electric vehicles will be an important part of that strategy, but given the time needed to transition the light-duty vehicle fleet, continued reliance on fossil fuels for electricity generation, the difficulty of electrifying medium and heavy-duty vehicles, and other barriers, electric vehicles alone will not get our transportation sector to net zero emissions by 2050. Today, there are more than 267 million light-duty vehicles in the U.S. Just 2.3 million of those vehicles, that's less than 1%, are battery electric or plug-in hybrid EVs. The other 99% run on liquid fuels. And the Energy Information Administration projects that 4 out of 5 new vehicles sold in 2050 will still be internal combustion engines requiring liquid fuels. So even with increased electric vehicle sales in the years ahead, it would take decades to turn over the fleet. And that means hundreds of billions of gallons of liquid fuels will continue to be burned for decades to come. So given these realities, other complementary solutions clearly will be needed to decarbonize transportation by mid-century. And that's where agriculture comes in. Through increased production and use of renewable fuels like ethanol, the agriculture sector offers an effective and immediate solution for decarbonizing all segments of the transportation sector. Today's corn ethanol already cuts greenhouse gas emissions by approximately 50% compared to gasoline, according to the Department of Energy, Harvard University, and others. With increased adoption of low-carbon farming practices, carbon capture, sequestration, and storage, and other technologies, we are well on our way to producing zero-carbon corn ethanol. In fact, the members of my organization are so confident about this that they adopted a resolution last July pledging to achieve a net-zero carbon footprint for corn ethanol by 2050 or sooner. But for this vision to become a reality, we need fairness and consistency in how the carbon footprint of different fuels and vehicles is measured. For ethanol's carbon footprint, regulators count the emissions associated with every step in the supply chain, from planting the seed all the way to delivering the fuel to the consumer at retail. For the carbon footprint of electric vehicles, however, the upstream emissions associated with electricity generation and battery manufacturing are often overlooked, giving the false impression that electric vehicles are zero emission vehicles. These overlooked emissions can be quite significant. In fact, analysis we have conducted shows that a Ford F-150 flex fuel vehicle, which happens to be what I drive, running on an 85% ethanol blend, will generate far fewer greenhouse gas emissions over its lifetime than a new Ford F-150 Lightning electric vehicle running on fossil-generated electricity. We believe any future decarbonization policy should take a technology-neutral, performance-based approach that focuses strictly on greenhouse gas emissions reduction and increasing fuel efficiency without dictating the use of specific fuels and vehicles to achieve those reductions. That's why we support the concept of a national low-carbon fuel standard. We also support the Next Generation Fuels Act that was introduced by Congresswoman Bustos, which establishes carbon performance and minimum octane standards for liquid fuels, again, without dictating what fuels would be used. In closing, we believe electric vehicles will play a key role in reducing emissions over the long term. But if we are serious about achieving a carbon-neutral transportation sector by 2050, we must take a comprehensive approach that also capitalizes on the ability of agriculture to deliver low and zero carbon renewable fuels.
Once again, Jeff Cooper, Renewable Fuels Association President and Chief Executive Officer, testifying before the
Federal House Agriculture Committee earlier this week.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.